You know, about 100 years ago, the church in many ways gave up on trying to integrate science with their faith. And it was because of Darwinism and naturalism, and they didn't know what to do, and they retreated. And I think in many ways we're still paying the price for that in the church. I don't know about you, but I've been raised in two or three churches that had a little bit of a anti-intellectual bent. But we're here tonight to try to reverse that trend. So what this is about is you get to go to the microphone back there and ask Dr. Ross any question that you can come up with. Think of it as Stump the Scientist tonight, okay? This Skeptics Forum is sponsored by the Paradox Sunday School class, which is in this very room from 11:15 to 12:30 every Sunday morning, and it is the best, I guarantee this, you can prove it scientifically, it's the best Sunday school class in America. How's that? Okay? Because... I'm not biased, okay? Dr. Ross is the teacher, and he's been teaching that class for about 28 years, plus or minus a millisecond or two, and it really is a great class. It did so much for me personally, integrating my faith with what was in my head and what I knew about science, and it's just been really, honestly, one of the most exciting things I've ever done in my life has been a part of this class. And in Paradox class, we wrestle with all these kinds of issues, philosophy, science, metaphysics, physics, the Bible. And if you love that kind of thing, you're welcome to come. And two or three times a year, the Paradox Sunday School class sponsors these Skeptics Forums. And we did one yesterday from 11 to 1. We do one tonight. And the next one, write this down, is January 8 and 9, which is also a Sunday, Monday. So, let's go through some of the guidelines here. Hugh's going to open with a couple of latest scientific discoveries, and when we say latest, we're talking like hot off the press from some publication that you've never heard of that's like 3 days old, okay? So, no one else has it yet. But as soon as people start coming to the mic, he will stop what he's doing and answer the question. We're going to go till about 9 o'clock. This is for you, okay? This is, hopefully you brought some really good questions. If you're not a believer, I hope you brought questions that you think will stump the Christian, okay? If you are a believer, we hope you brought the questions that may be stumping you through your walk with the Lord. If you're dying to ask a question and you're just too shy to go to the mic, find me. I'll be wandering around, or write it down on a piece of paper and give it to me, and I'll be happy to go to the microphone for you and ask your question. I already have one that somebody gave me over there. So we also have a couple of things on your seats. The larger card is from the Paradox Sunday School class. If you wouldn't mind filling that out, even if you are a Paradox attender, there's some things on there for you, but especially if you're new, we'd like to find out how you heard about this, okay? And the smaller card is from Reasons to Believe. If you fill out the back and hand it to Diana, raise your hand, who is always cheerful and helpful. If you fill out the back of that card and take it over to her and smile, she will give you an Astronomer's Quest, which is a CD that is... Would you explain an Astronomer's Quest for us?
Yes, it's the testimony of Hugh Ross and how he came to faith through the science of astronomy and physics, and he'll give some of that to CD, but it's pretty amazing, and if you don't want it, give one to a friend. It's quite amazing once you've heard it. If you don't believe someone of high intelligence does a fine God, listen to this, and it'll really make a difference. Thank you.
Outstanding. Thank you, Paradox class, for treats. There's some goodies back there in case all this stimulates your desire for food. Again, the next Skeptics Forums are going to be January 8 and 9. A couple of guidelines for the microphone. You're free to ask as many questions as you want to ask, but we ask that if you want to ask a second question and there's a line, please go to the end of the line. And that's like not, you know, question one doesn't have five parts to it, okay? It's like, if it's two questions, please, because the line can get pretty long. Our speaker this evening, as always, is Dr. Hugh Ross. Hugh Ross teaches the Paradox Sunday School class, and I'd like to tell you why he is qualified to be the guy at the microphone for 2 hours. He is the president and founder of Reasons to Believe. He has a Bachelor of Science in Physics from the University of British Columbia. He has a PhD in Astronomy from the University of Toronto. He's written about 14 books. I think I said he's the president and founder of Reasons to Believe. And he's a wonderful guy, truly. He really is. It's an honor to know, for me to know him. We have a book table over there that has most of those 14 books, plus a few other books written by other people that work at Reasons to Believe, some of the other scholars. And if you're interested, RTB's Reasons to Believe's website is reasons, plural, reasons.org. And I think that's all my notes. So let's say a prayer, and we'll bring Dr. Ross up. Lord God, we're so grateful that you gave us a mind that we can really try to think through these tough things that you've given us in life. You've given us a book, the Bible. You've given us the book of nature, and we can try to integrate those two things. Thank you for our mind that we can do that with, and the curiosity and the sense of fun that we have trying to put all this together. We thank you for your Son who gives us the motivation and the reason to try to do all that. Bless this time that we have together tonight. Bless each one of us here. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Ross, please come up to the microphone.
Thank you. Well, unlike Ross Hoagland here, I was not raised in a Christian home. I didn't get to meet Christians until I was 27 years of age. That's because they're hard to find in Canada. That's where I grew up. But I got into astronomy when I was 7 years of age, and from the age of eight onwards, I knew that would be my future career. And every year I would kind of look at a different subdiscipline of science, and at age 16, studied cosmology. And that's where I realized that the universe came about as a result of a Big Bang. And if it's a Big Bang, there's a beginning. If there's a beginning, there must be a beginner. And so from the age of 16 onwards, I didn't doubt the existence of God, but I was very skeptical of this idea that the God that created the universe would communicate through a book. But after 2 years of going through the holy books, religions of the world, became persuaded that the Bible indeed was inspired by the one that created the universe. When I arrived on the Caltech campus, that's where I met Christians for the first time. They showed me how to find a church, and it turned out to be this church. And I've actually been on the staff of this church a little more than 36 years now. And the class, Paradoxes, has actually been running for that period of time. It was this church that helped me launch Reasons to Believe 26 years ago. And it's an organization that focuses on new reasons to believe in the Christian faith. And one of the ways we express that is through a vehicle called Today's New Reason to Believe. Every second day we give you an article on some brand new scientific discoveries that enable us to put to the test different worldviews, Christianity, atheism, agnosticism, evolution, etc. It's a free service. Go to our website. You can get it automatically sent to your computer. You can even get it automatically sent to your friend's computer. But I would get their permission first before you do that. And then several times a week, we do what's called a science news flash, where we jump on a new scientific discovery literally within hours after the discovery has been announced. In fact, just this afternoon, I did three of them, and there'll be some of them are uploaded already. And this is what runs about 15, 20 minutes, where we discuss some new scientific discovery. And you can enroll in that on either iTunes or reasons.org, and again, it's free. And now you don't even need a computer. You can get all this through a Reasons to Believe app. If you've got a smartphone, you can get free of charge the Reasons to Believe app, and it'll give you access to all these wonderful resources. And as you heard, we gave you these cards. Feel free to take them home. It's got a little informative thing there on the questions we typically get from skeptics. But there's also a little tear-off sheet that you can fill out. And if you do that, you'll get the 45-minute version of how astrophysics brought me into the Christian faith. And you'll also be enrolled to get a free magazine. It's actually an electronic magazine that you can download and print. And so this is the item you can get in Astronomer's Quest. Well, the microphone's there for you to ask questions. And as soon as people go to that microphone, I'm going to quit talking. But I thought you'd be interested to know about, I actually call it the Darth Vader planet. It's been known for some time, but only the past couple of days have astronomers realized how very dark this planet is. It is by far the darkest body we've been able to see. It's got the wonderful name TRES-2b. Don't you love the way astronomers pick names for the planets that they discover? And it's orbiting a star called GSC-03549-02811. Not quite like the Star Wars thing, is it? No. But this is a planet that is transiting its star. And what they mean by transiting is that our planet Earth happens to be directly in the line of sight with the star and the planetary plane. And so we're actually able to observe the planet crossing between us and its star. And when it does, the light of the star dims a little bit. Well, kind of like our moon or the planets, they have phases. And so we're able to observe this planet going across its star at different phases, and that would affect what kind of light dimming you get. And so the lower the reflectivity, the lower the amount of variation you're going to get in the dimming of the star as a result of the phases of the planet. And by that means, they're able to prove that this planet reflects less than 1% of the light that it receives from the star. So it's absorbing more than 99% of the light and heat that falls upon it. And just to give you a point of comparison, our planet Earth reflects 37% of the light that it receives. Venus, 65%. The gas giants in our solar system reflect anywhere from 41 to 52% of the light that falls on it. That would be Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, and Jupiter. The darkest bodies are the Moon. It only reflects 12%, and Mercury reflects just 11%. That's because they don't have any atmosphere and they got very dark rocks. But this planet, TRES-2b, only reflects less than 1% of the light that falls on it. And what makes it more remarkable, it's a gas giant. Now, gas giants have a huge amount of gas. I mean, they're predominantly gas, and they're typically highly reflective. For some reason, this planet, a gas giant the size of Jupiter, is not reflecting light. Now, what all this means is that there must be a brand new discovered means of planet formation, because there's no way planets that we've been studying. We've discovered now 567 planets outside of our solar system with known characteristics, but this one sticks out like a sore thumb. There's no other planet like it. And what this is telling us is that there must be a much wider variety of pathways by which planets form. Now, why is this important in terms of whether or not God's involved in all this? I remember back in 1995 when the first planet outside of our solar system was discovered. And the presumption at that time was, as we continue to discover more extrasolar planets, they will all be just like the planets in our solar system, proving that our solar system is quite ordinary. Well, it's been 15, 16 years now, and the accumulated evidence tells us that none of the extrasolar planets we have found are anything like any of the solar system planets. Not just not like Earth, not like any of the planets. We're not finding any twins of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, or Neptune, no twins of Venus, no twins of the Earth, nothing like our solar system planets. And so what we've been seeing over the past 16 years is that the more we learn about extrasolar planets, the greater the evidence accumulates that the planets in our solar system have been specially designed to make advanced life possible on planet Earth. In fact, before the discovery of extrasolar planets, the presumption simply was we need a highly fine-tuned star, namely our Sun, a highly fine-tuned moon orbiting our planet, and of course the Earth must be highly fine-tuned, but it doesn't really matter what the other planets look like. Thanks to the discovery of extrasolar planets, we now recognize every single planet in our solar system plays a critical role in making advanced life possible here on planet Earth. And as I shared with people yesterday, when Thanksgiving comes along, you might want to thank God for Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Venus, Mercury, Mars. All those are necessary in order for you to enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. But this Darth Vader planet is yet one more piece of evidence that we live in a highly fine-tuned designed solar system. We already got people at the microphone. I got more of these things to talk about, but as we advertise, this is your forum, not our forum. You can ask us any question you want. Go ahead.
Mr. Ross, I wanted to ask you about space-time dimensions. I personally believe there's 11 with the Creator in the 11th moving through the other 10, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on that, and then how that compares to, in the Bible, first heaven, second heaven, third heaven. Could those be space-time dimensions?
Well, until a couple of decades ago, the textbook description of dimensionality was that there's length, width, and height, and that's it. But what happened at Caltech about 20 years ago is a research group led by the physicist John Schwartz got together a group of graduate students and began to look at the problem posed by gravity and quantum mechanics. And the problem is that that the symmetries that you see in quantum mechanics and gravity that are necessary to make life possible cannot possibly fit into just four space-time dimensions. And that's the first time physicists realize there must be more dimensions to the physical reality of the universe. And when Schwartz's team got started, they quickly figured out that the right answer must be somewhere between 8 and 26 dimensions of space. And it took some incredible collaborative work by theoretical physicists to narrow it down. And today we know that the right answer is that there are six small dimensions of space that accompany length, width, and height. Now, a lot of people conflate that with string theory. String theory is simply a subset of this nine spatial dimensional model for the universe. No physicist or astronomer today would deny the existence of nine space dimensions. It's really the only way we can put quantum mechanics and gravity together. Moreover, when physicists produced this nine-dimensional theory, it spontaneously generated all the equations of special and general relativity. It is such that if we'd never had an Albert Einstein, we'd have all of his theories today, thanks to the recognition that we live in a universe with three large dimensions of space and six small dimensions of space. It also solved about a half a dozen problems we were facing with black holes. And so because it explains so much and predicts so much, there is no doubt that the universe has nine space dimensions. So it's nine dimensions of space and one dimension of time. Now, you might say, how come we haven't figured this out before? Well, those six extra dimensions of space are very, very tiny. You can basically visualize them as dimensions that are wrapped very tightly around the three big dimensions. Let me give you an example. Okay, here I've got a two-dimensional sheet of paper. And you notice it's got length and it's got width. But I could actually roll it up like a scroll, like this. And if I were to roll it up very, very tightly, instead of seeing two dimensions of space, you would just see a line. And so that's one way two dimensions can be made to look like a single dimension. Now, the cross-section of these six dimensions that accompany the three big ones measures 10 to the minus 35 meters. Now, that's 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron, which is why nobody really noticed it until a few years ago. It's just way too tiny. It didn't cast a shadow, right? But I'll tell you what it's done for our cosmic creation model. we now realize that the universe started off with nine rapidly expanding dimensions of space. All nine rapidly expanded from the cosmic creation event. But at 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the cosmic creation event, six of them stopped expanding. And they're still the same size that they were when the universe was less than a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. And so that's when they stopped. And you say, what made it stop? What made it stop was the force of gravity separating out from the other three forces of physics, the force of electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear force. That's what's called a symmetry breaking in physics. And that symmetry breaking has to be extraordinarily fine-tuned in order to later produce a universe that would make possible the existence of life. So hopefully I've given you another thing to thank God for in Thanksgiving, that he created the universe with nine dimensions of space and ensured that six would stop expanding at exactly 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the cosmic creation event. And what is exciting for me is that this discovery enabled us to unify our cosmic creation model with our particle creation model. And so we've got a completely consistent picture now of creation that's consistent with what the Bible talks about in terms of God creating the universe independent of space and time and continuously expanding it from the beginning of the universe. So, you had a follow-up?
So you think there's 10 or there's 11 or how many do you think?
The physical universe is described by 10 space-time dimensions. However, the space-time theorems tell us that the cause of the universe must be some entity that is able to operate completely independent of the 10 space-time dimensions. And by definition, cause and effect requires some temporal dimensional context. And that's where people have gotten the idea that there must be the equivalent of 11th dimension. But technically, it may not be a dimension at all. It's simply some means by which cause and effect phenomena can take place independent of cosmic time. And this is consistent with what the Bible teaches, that God was having temporal experiences before he created time, or miraculously before he created cosmic time. One of the characteristics of the universe is it's constrained to linear time, where time is one dimension only that can't be stopped or reversed. That doesn't mean that temporality, therefore, must be constrained to linear time. The Bible speaks about God dwelling in the equivalent of geometric time, and how when evil is conquered, humanity will be ushered into a realm where there won't be just singular time, but geometric time.
And do you think, like, second heaven, third heaven that I see in the Bible, are those space-time dimensions? Can you say that?
No, that's okay. The problem with reading the Bible in the English translation is that our English language has an enormous vocabulary. You know, it's about 175,000 words you need to know just to be able to communicate well in English, but 4 million if you want to be able to communicate at a scientific level. Biblical Hebrew, if you don't count the proper nouns, you're only looking at 3,000 words. So virtually every Hebrew noun has multiple literal definitions. So for example, you go through Genesis 1, it uses the word Shema or Shemayin for heaven. It's got three different definitions. The word for earth has five different definitions. And that's why Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 11 that he was taken up to the third heaven to distinguish between the other two definitions. What are those definitions? Well, one of the definitions of the Hebrew word for heaven would be the troposphere, that realm of our atmosphere where rain clouds form or where raindrops fall. Basically, you know, anything up to about 20,000 feet would be in that category. The second heaven would be the realm of the planets, stars, and galaxies. And the third heaven would be the transcendent realm where the angels dwell, where God rules. So it's that realm, the spirit realm, beyond the universe itself. And how the Bible distinguishes this? It uses a phrase in the Old Testament, the heavens and the earth. That refers to the whole physical universe. But the phrase heaven and earth refers to the universe plus this spirit angelic realm. because God not only created the physical universe, He created another realm where the angels dwell and operate. So that's why you have three heavens in the Bible. That's why you got 4 days in the Bible. There's 4 different definitions for the word day, 5 for the earth. And if you go into a Hebrew lexicon, it's like that for virtually every Hebrew noun, which is why it's a challenge to translate it from Hebrew into English, which is why you need 16 different translations.
But I heard recently that there's a theory that there was that we actually had 2 moons at one time. Earth did.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Yes, this was published in Science just a few days ago. The idea that the Earth at one time had 2 moons instead of a single moon. Our moon didn't always exist. There was a time when the Earth had no moons, but there was a planet sharing the orbit of the moon. And that's mathematically possible. It's what's called the Lagrange point. If you go along the orbit of the Earth and you go forward 60 degrees or backward 60 degrees, that's a spot where another planet can share the same orbit as the Earth. And physicists have been able to determine that when the Earth was formed, there was a second planet sharing its orbit at that Lagrange point, and that the planet was about twice the mass of Mars. Now, celestial mechanics tells us that that will be permanently stable if you're only looking at 3 bodies, the Sun, the Earth, and this planet that's twice the mass of Mars. However, if you've got Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune in the same system, it's simply a matter of time before the lighter of the 2 planets sharing the same orbit will be destabilized. And when that happens, it gets jiggled away a little bit from the Lagrange point, then it starts to creep very slowly towards the Earth. And it was that slowly creeping planet moving along the orbit of Earth towards the Earth that eventually led that planet, twice the mass of Mars, to collide with the Earth at a low velocity and a high attack angle into an extremely deep ocean. That was a time when the Earth had an ocean about 500 times more extensive than it is right now. So it was very deep. And this Mars body, twice the size of Mars, hitting that ocean at a low velocity and a high attack angle. What I mean by that is, say, if this is the Earth, that we'd have this body coming in at about a 45 degree angle. And in hitting that very deep ocean, what happens is almost all the heavy element material in the collider falls into the core and the mantle of the Earth. And all the light element material in both the Earth and the collider get blasted away into a debris cloud around the Earth. And that debris cloud coalesces into the moon. So it explains why the moon has a lighter composition than the Earth. It explains why the Earth is the densest body in the solar system. It explains why the Earth has so much uranium and thorium in it, all of which is necessary to establish a strong, permanent magnetic field. And without that magnetic field, we'd be killed by the radiation from the Sun and cosmic rays. And it also enables continents to form in 2 ways. The collision got rid of more than 99% of the Earth's water. It also got rid of more than 99% of our atmosphere, because there was a time when Earth had an atmosphere that was about 3 times denser than Venus, which would have made life impossible. But thanks to the collision, we lost 99% of our atmosphere. We lost more than 99% of our water, which means we have a thin water veneer on the surface, and we have enough uranium and thorium in the core of the Earth that it drives plate tectonics. So although the Earth started off as a water world, the water layer was thin enough that plate tectonic activity could generate the continents. And because of continents and oceans coexisting on the surface, we got nutrient recycling, which makes advanced life possible. So again, something to give thanks for when Thanksgiving comes around. Did I answer that question completely enough? I'm not sure I caught all the parts of that question, but if not, the second moon. Oh, yeah. Okay. What was discovered just a few days ago is that, of course, we've known for some time the back side of the moon looks a lot different than the front side. If you ever looked at photographs, the front side has all these seas. That's not true. The back side, it's got heavy pockmarkings all over it. And for years, astronomers have been trying to explain why the front side looks so different than the back side. Well, they've been able to calculate that when the moon formed, if there was a very small body that existed with the moon, so think of it as this way, you got the Earth, you got the moon, and then you got a really tiny moon that is accompanying the big moon, where relatively quickly that smaller moon collides with the big moon, and that explains why one side is so different than the other side. The latest issue of Science has got a whole article explaining how if you've got a moon of just the right size and just the right proximity to our moon, it's kind of like our moon having its own moon, and that would explain why the two sides are so different. So, anyway, you can check the article out online. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the great questions of all time is why is there something rather than nothing? And for a long time, we have used that as an argument for creation. But Stephen Hawking and others have been doing a lot of work trying to come up with the mathematics to demonstrate another way that there could be something just due to the nature of things. I wonder if you could comment on that at all. Is that are those models actually working, or is this...
Well, there's two ways people have been trying to get something out of nothing. Maybe the U.S. business community can learn something from this. But one was Vilenkin, a famous astronomer, saying maybe nothing is unstable. And what he meant by that is you could have pure nothing and it bifurcates into, thank you, nothing and something, or nothing, pardon me, something and anti-something. So you start with absolutely nothing, and it bifurcates into something and anti-something, and says that explains the universe in which we live. Well, it doesn't really work, because the universe is slightly asymmetric. In fact, there's a very popular book written called The Left Hand of Creation, which makes the point that the universe isn't an exact balance between anti-stuff and real stuff. Rather, there's always slightly more real stuff than there is anti-stuff. And so, for example, when the universe was created, there was no matter at all, but energy eventually led to the development of matter at about 10 to the minus 11 seconds after the cosmic creation event. And at that point, the universe was almost perfectly balanced between antimatter and matter. Then there was a great annihilation event where the antimatter made contact with the matter and produces huge amount of energy. But there was some matter left over. And what we now realize is that the ratio was about 100 billion and one real particles for every 100 billion antiparticles. So all these 200 billion galaxies you see in the universe today, that's that one out of 100 billion that's left over. But the whole point is it demonstrates that the universe isn't exactly bifurcated. It's very slightly asymmetric. In fact, we see those asymmetries all over the physical landscape. And therefore, the idea that nothing can bifurcate into something and anti-something really doesn't work. Moreover, what would cause nothing to go through that bifurcation? You have to have a cause to generate that, which is something. So that's another reason philosophically why it wouldn't work. Well, a second approach has been this appeal to what we see in quantum mechanics. And in quantum mechanics, you can have a space-time quantum foam that will produce virtual particles. And we've got experiments that prove that really works. And I'm not talking about making particles out of energy. I'm talking about making particles out of space-time quantum fluctuations. So it's not E equals mc squared. And incidentally, I can just share with this with you, when the universe was first created, there was no heat energy in the universe. What we had was space curvature, nine dimensions of space squished into an infinitesimal ball. But it was the release of space curvature that led to the production of photons. at about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, which later led to the production of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And so space curvature is not nothing, it's something. And that space curvature can generate particles, and as I said, virtual particles. But here's the problem. When you produce those virtual particles, they're subject to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which means they need to go back into the quantum space-time foam before the human observer can tell or detect the production of the particle. Now, we know the phenomena goes on, but we can't actually detect the particles. That's because they return to the quantum space-time foam so quickly. How quickly are we talking about? Well, the longest you're going to be able to keep those virtual particles is something less than a trillionth of a second. And so the idea that quantum space-time fluctuations are responsible for creating the universe fails on the fact that we know the universe is nearly 14 billion years old. That's a lot more time than a trillionth of a second. But here's another problem. Quantum mechanics can't do anything without time. The probability of getting a quantum outcome is proportional to the passage of time. The more time that passes, the higher the probability you're going to get a quantum outcome. But the beginning of the universe is the beginning of time, which means you have to explain how the universe came about with no time at all. And if there's no time at all, then that means there's no quantum explanation possible for how the universe arose. And so, by the way, all these arguments were vetted within the physics community about 5 to 6 years ago, and the idea that the universe could physically be created out of nothing has been abandoned. On the other hand, it is the heart of the Christian faith that the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. We're not talking about a creation of the universe out of absolutely nothing, but the heart of the Christian faith is that the universe of matter, energy, space, and time did not come from anything which we identify as matter, energy, space, and time. And I think it was about 15 years ago, I gave a series of sermons here in this church, which were titled, Everything You Want to Know About Nothing, making the point that in physics, we have five different definitions of nothing. And so when a physicist talks about making something out of nothing, you have to ask him, what kind of nothing are you talking about? And just to give you a quick summary, one definition of nothing is a complete absence of matter. But you can take energy and make matter out of it. So the absence of matter is not real nothing. Well, another definition is the absence of all matter in energy. But you can make that from space curvature. So that's not real nothing either. You can say, well, the absence of matter, energy, space, and time. But the space-time theorems prove that there must be something beyond space and time that created the universe. So that's not real nothing either.
So does that mean that they've abandoned Hawking's mathematics on this issue?
Oh, now where Hawking is going in his mathematics is that he is speculating. You'll see this in his book, A Brief History of Time. He says, if we assume that the universe in which we live, instead of being constrained to linear time that can't be stopped or reversed, has an addition to physical linear time, imaginary time, which means he's attributing two dimensions of time to the universe. And he says, if we do that, then there's no need for the universe to have a beginning, there's no need for God. Well, the problem with that, and he actually admits that in his book, A Brief History of Time, is we have many experiments in physics that tell us that the universe in which we live really is constrained to linear time that can't be stopped or reversed, in which case you really do need a causal agent beyond space and time to explain where the universe came from. And that's something you've got to watch when physicists write for the, their popular audiences. Often they talk about what-ifs, and therefore you need to say, well, okay, where is the speculation in all this? And that'll help you to understand. And, you know, as a philosopher friend of mine put it, physicists are notorious for not telling the readers when they've stepped out of being in the physicist's role and have taken the philosophical role or the speculative role. Now, the one exception to that is a physics journal called Physics Letters B. That's a journal that's dedicated to allowing mathematicians and physicists to speculate to their heart's content. And so when you pick up that journal, you realize this is not physical reality. but it is an opportunity to develop new mathematical tools that possibly might have applications once we discover more about the physical realm. So in that sense, I'm saying it's a worthwhile journal to have.
I have a question from the audience, Hugh. And if you thought that last one was hard, wait till you hear this one. The Bible states that a woman should not teach in the church or have authority over a man. What do you think? Our church has a woman do sermons sometimes. Is this wrong?
Okay, good question. And it's a question that we wrestled with at this church, 29 years ago. That was part of the study committee to deal with that very issue. Should we allow a woman to teach in the church? Now, kind of what we do in our paradoxes class is we love to address all these controversial issues. But rule number one is we don't get into any discussion or debate until we look up every single verse in the Bible that deals with that subject. And what we discovered is there's only one verse in the Bible that forbids a woman to exercise ministry. And that's 1 Timothy 2:5, where Paul says, I forbid a woman to preach. And the Greek word is authentein. Now, everywhere else, you've got Paul talking about women prophesying and teaching. So evidently, it's okay for women to prophesy and to teach and to pray in public in front of a mixed audience, but they're not allowed to authentein. And so he said, what is Paul getting at with that word authentein? Now, the difficulty is it's only used once in the entire New Testament. And so what we had to do is go outside the Bible to see how that word is used in Greek literature. And what we discovered is it means to teach with authority, where the teacher is exercising authority over the audience and basically commanding them to change their way of life and their behavior. And we said, well, that's interesting. And then we did a series of experiments here in this church because we said, maybe that restriction should apply to men as well as to women. And so, this church is filled with scientists and engineers, so we said, let's see if we can discover what Paul is getting at here. And what we discovered is that when we allowed a man to teach a woman's Bible study, where that man was exercising authority over the women and exhorting them how to change their way of life, they got two responses from the women. The women either worshipped the teacher or they despised him. And we said, either way, that's not a good thing. And then we did the reverse, where if we allowed a woman to do that with men or a mixed audience, and either way, we noticed that the men in the audience would either worship the woman or they would despise her. And we said, okay, I think we understand what's going on here. Paul is trying to protect the teacher from being despised or being worshipped. And it's just simply a recognition that this is human behavior with the sexes. You know, he made male and female different, tells us that in Genesis, and they're going to respond to one another in distinct ways. So the rule of thumb we have here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church is a woman is free to teach men, providing they stick to teaching, where they're not exercising authority over the men in the audience. And same thing, we don't let men do that with the women. And the whole principle is one of division of labor. Because what I've seen is women reacting, saying, hey, you know, if you men aren't going to do it, we're going to do it. And I say, well, wait a minute. It also tells us in the Bible the workers are few. And if we're going to be effective in doing what God wants us to do, we have to specialize and divide our labor. And there's plenty of ministry for the men to do and plenty of ministry for the women to do. By the way, something else we observed in these experiments, that when we would allow a man to exercise authority over a woman's Bible study, the women in the group would abdicate. They'd stop ministering. And the same thing we noticed with men, when we allowed a woman to exercise authority from the pulpit over the men in terms of how they should live, you begin to see the men abdicating from their ministry responsibilities. And God's goal is to get as many people involved in ministry as possible. So that took 6 months for us to figure it out. And I think it was a combination of the Bible study, looking at other Greek literature, and actually doing experiments and seeing what the consequences were when we violated what God said in the book of 1 Timothy. I think it's 2 Timothy, by the way. So,
Mr. Ross, I wanted to ask you about the where hell could be. Like I've heard, it's in the middle of the earth by many Christian and pastor leaders. Is that a spiritual thing? Is it a physical thing? What's going on there in the core of the earth?
Well, the confusion is when you look at descriptions of heaven and hell in the Bible, they're referred to as being up and down. But what you notice in the book of Revelation, there comes a time when God permanently removes all evil and suffering. And at that point, the universe will fulfill its purpose. In fact, one of the books I got over there, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, explains how God chose certain laws of physics to target the problem of evil and suffering. But once evil and suffering is conquered and removed, there's no longer any need for the physics of the universe or the dimensions of the universe, and God replaces the universe with a brand new realm called a new creation. But when that happens, heaven and hell survive. So what that tells us is that heaven and hell have nothing to do with the physical universe. They're transcendent to the space-time dimensions of the universe, which raises the question then, why do certain biblical texts refer to hell as being down and heaven as being up? Well, another book over there, Beyond the Cosmos, tries to explain Christian theology in the context of all these dimensions we now know must exist. And it's hard to visualize dimensions you don't experience, but it's relatively easy to visualize dimensions that you can experience as not existing. And so one of the analogies we do is we conceive of a world that's flat, where you got length and width, but no height. So consider the top of this computer, for example, and consider two-dimensional beings living in this two-dimensional world. And I'm trying to tell them where my feet are, down. Trying to tell them where my head is, up. They think it's this way and this way, because they only have the two dimensions to work with. They don't realize that there's a dimension transcendent to their dimension. And so when Jesus talks about heaven being up and hell being below, he's referring to dimensions beyond what we can experience. So.
Hi. My question's more of a man's relationship and women's relationships to God. With Jesus in the New Testament, he's always consistent in his attitude and his messages are very strong. There's no confusion. But if I look at the Old Testament and where God was helping people get into Egypt or out of Egypt, and where God, say, spoke to Noah, or someone spoke for God to Noah, build this ark, and I guess he didn't like the rest of the world at that time, he just liked Noah. There's many examples where he spoke or an angel spoke for him or her, whatever God is. So it's really hard for me. The typical answer I'll get is God will not interfere with free will. But I don't see why on certain instances in the world that have been our biggest calamities, whether it's the Holocaust or in our country, slavery, or even a big tsunami in Japan that wipes out millions of people, I don't understand why there's no communication. It's like I would think he would tell the Pope, you better watch some of those priests, you know, they might be hurting children. I would think he would have advised people in Japan, there's a big problem coming. I don't want children and people to go. I don't understand, where's the communication? Because it talks about in the Old Testament, it talks about it in the New Testament, that he speaks through an angel or he speaks directly to somebody. It's like no speaking. Where is it?
Well, it's a good question. And you know, God still communicates directly to people just like he did in the Old Testament, just like he did in the Gospels. But what you notice in the Old Testament and the Gospels, although God would perform direct communication, often face-to-face, where he would do miracles, people would be raised from the dead, it's a rare event. It doesn't happen that frequently. Now, the question is, why does God sometimes intervene, and why does most of the time he doesn't? Well, it's a question I take up in this book over there called Why the Universe is the Way It Is. Recognizing that God sets up the laws of physics and exquisitely designs the laws of physics to restrain evil and to encourage virtue amongst his human creatures. And this is something Jesus addressed in the Gospels, where people said, you know, the Tower of Siloam that fell and killed all those people, was it because those people were wicked? And then Jesus responded and said, no, it's got nothing to do with their wickedness. Towers fall down. And he also made the point, build your house on a rock, not on a sand. Things will happen. The laws of physics will bring about certain consequences. Now, there are times when God will transcend the laws of physics and rescue people. But he only does that where the rescuing will have a greater impact on restraining evil and encouraging virtue than simply letting the laws of physics run. And so this really explains why God chooses not to intervene, because if he intervened all the time, the laws of physics would have no effect. So it's kind of like me as a parent working with my sons. I let the laws of physics bring about the appropriate discipline that they need so that they can pursue virtue and avoid evil. In fact, what I told my sons is, you know, if I don't discipline you, the laws of physics will.
Well, that makes sense. But let's take, say, Northern Ireland, and maybe the Protestants and the Catholics, they're going to fight on and keep killing each other. And it seems like, I don't know, it seems like there should be some kind of message. I don't know how long they've been doing this, and there's other parts of the world too where people just keep fighting on and fighting on. And it just seems like somebody should, that God or his angels should say, this is so petty and stupid. Why are you killing each other over some little teeny thing? I never meant the Bible to split people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I also know this, that when people suffer, God can use that suffering to communicate to people that are watching the suffering. I've seen that in my own life. I've seen that in the life of others. In fact, what you see in the New Testament epistles is if you give your life to Jesus Christ, then God's going to bring more suffering in your life because he's going to use that suffering as a tool to reach other people. But he encourages us by saying, yes, there's going to be evil in your life. Yes, there's going to be suffering in your life. And yes, there's going to be the second law of thermodynamics, which means everything you touch is going to decay. And you're going to have to do a lot of maintenance just to keep things from decaying away. And you're not going to like it. But all that's necessary to bring about the end of all evil and suffering once and for all. And he encourages us by this. You only got to put up with it for 80 or 90 years. And then you get to enjoy an eternity where never again will there be any evil or suffering. And it's not just for our benefit, it's for the benefit of the angels. As Paul explains, we human beings are on the playing field of God's great game, and the angels are in the stands watching us. We get to directly experience the grace of God working through us. They're only allowed to watch the grace of God working through us. And so the pain and the suffering we're going through not only benefits the human beings, other people, and myself, it benefits the angelic realm as well. And a good analogy, I think, is what happens when you go to university. You sign up for several courses. Well, guess what's going to happen in those courses? You're going to suffer. I've been both a professor and a student, and I realize my job as a professor is to make my students suffer. And if I don't make them suffer enough, I know they're going to complain to the dean and say, the course is too easy. Now, what rationally would cause students to complain to the dean and say, I want to suffer some more? Well, it's because they recognize the benefit of the suffering. They also recognize the brevity of the suffering. They only have to put up with my suffering for 4 months. Then they're done with me. But they also realize that if they respond appropriately to the suffering as training and preparation, that will prepare them for a rewarding career that might last 40 or 50 years. And the struggle I see in talking to people about how the laws of physics are designed and why God doesn't choose to intervene very frequently with those laws of physics is we don't understand the benefit of the suffering that we're going through and the reward that we're going to gain in the new creation. And it's going to be for all eternity. And matter of fact, the words of both Peter and Paul are, relish the suffering, because the greater the suffering, the greater your eternal reward will be in the new creation. And it's kind of like the students I have that take my courses. What I notice is the best students are the students that relish the suffering. They're like, you know, give me more, professor. And, you know, they're just so eager to learn and get the training. But it's the students I have in my class that don't really have a career goal. They complain, this course is too hard. And so I say, you know, it'd be better off if you don't take this course until you have a career goal. When you got a clear career goal, then come back and take the course. And so I think it's the same with us human beings. We need that clear career goal. And that's why Paul says, focus every day on your eternal hope. It will give you the perseverance to get through the suffering, the trials, the evil, the pain. So hopefully that helps. And if you need more, read the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. It's actually our easiest to read book.
We're going to take a quick break, just long enough to switch the CDs, the recording. So like 4 minutes.
Like you said before, 100 years ago, we didn't need this in the United States. We just believed, and that was okay. But that's no longer okay in this day and age. And in my own family, my husband and I are new Christians, and we have grown-up children that were raised and went to college, and they have no idea that this even exists. So, excuse me, I'm a little nervous. I have two questions. The first one is from 1 Corinthians 15:52, where it says, the trumpet will sound in a twinkling of an eye. I've always wondered how fast that was. What do you think of that?
Well, the twinkling of an eye has actually been measured.
Really?
Yeah. It's roughly a billionth of a second, so it's pretty fast.
Okay. And then my second question is a little more extensive. Could you draw out a timeline that shows when creation was, when Adam and Eve was, and where dinosaurs, Neanderthals, and all the things that are out there, where they happened? Just briefly.
Okay.
I know you can't go into great detail, but
right.
Just so I could get in my mind's eye the order of things and how
okay.
It happened.
The cosmic creation event, 13.75 billion years ago, plus or minus 0.11 billion. Okay? Then fast forward the formation of the Earth. That was 4.5662 billion years ago. That's known to five places of the decimal. That's very accurately pinned down. Origin of life, about 3.83 billion years ago. So that's the beginning of creation, day one. Day one is where you got the origin of life. And then the Cambrian explosion, which is creation, beginning of creation, day five, where you get the first animals, animals with limbs and internal organs. That's 543 million years ago. The dinosaurs, the first of the dinosaurs are the Triassic dinosaurs, and they appeared 250 million years ago. And they were on the Earth for a little more than 50 million years and were driven by extinction by extraterrestrial colliders. And they were replaced by the Jurassic dinosaurs. And it's a very powerful evidence against an evolutionary paradigm, because you've got the complete extinction of all the Triassic dinosaurs. And by the way, for those 50 million years, we don't see any change. The dinosaurs at the end of the 50 million years are the same as the ones at the beginning of the 50 million years. Then come the Jurassic dinosaurs, and they show up less than 10,000 years after the Triassic dinosaurs are wiped out. So complete new set of very large-bodied animals. And what puts that in context is biologists have now conceded that if an animal has a size bigger than 3 kilograms body weight, it will go extinct before it evolves. Well, dinosaurs are clearly a lot bigger than 3 kilograms. But same thing with the Jurassic dinosaurs. They're here for 65 million years, and we don't see any evolution. Then they get wiped out, completely wiped out and replaced by the Cretaceous dinosaurs, and they remain for 80 million years with no measurable change. 65 million years ago, the last of the dinosaurs gets wiped out by an asteroid that collided in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. Now, where do human beings arise? If you calibrate the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies, you'll get a date for God creating Adam and Eve somewhere around 50, 60,000 years ago. Noah, roughly 40,000 years ago. And that's consistent with what are called the cultural Big Bangs. You know, when God created the Neanderthals, their technology was stagnant. They didn't wear clothes. The tools they had 150,000 years ago are the same as the tools when they went extinct. So they never developed any advance of technology. When humans show up 50, 60,000 years ago, there are cultural revolutions that burst upon the scene. Immediately they're wearing clothes. Immediately they have advanced tools. I'm talking hammers and axes, needles with an eye in it so that they can sew fur to make clothes. We see art and music, and we see jewelry. It's the first time you ever see jewelry. And what's really incredible is the jewelry is about 10 times as extensive as the tools. I think the ratio is about the same today. So, and, you know, anthropologists thought for sure that this jewelry had some other purpose. But as they've examined it, it only has purpose for jewelry. There's no food value. There's no tool value. It's simply for body decoration. Well, we can now date those cultural Big Bangs, and the dates come in at about 40 to 50,000 years ago. We also have DNA evidence, which establishes when the first woman lived and when the first man lived, that comes in at 50 to 60,000 years. So the dates are all consistent. And the new DNA evidence is so compelling that in the scientific literature, the reigning paradigm for explaining human origins is termed the Garden of Eden hypothesis, because of how closely it matches what the Bible teaches, namely that we're descended from one man, one woman. The DNA evidence also tells us the location of that first man and first woman, and it's consistent with the biblical story of Eden. So, and they actually refer in the scientific literature to the first man as Adam and the first woman as Eve. So they're using biblical terminology all over the place.
Is what you just said in one of the books over there?
Well, a book that will probably give, I mean, you know, we have books that give you pieces of it, like Who is Adam? It's all about human origins. And we've got a book on the origin of life. But we have a book called More Than a Theory, which summarizes the content in 8 other books. And More Than a Theory gives you the full scope of our biblical creation model.
Thank you, Dr.
Okay.
Well, then, did the first human beings collect antiques and play fantasy stickball?
I'm not sure they played fantasy NFL football, but I'm sure they had antiques.
I know that there's numerous methods for dating the Earth, the age of the Earth. How about the Moon and Mars? That we sent exploration vehicles to Mars, and they did geology experiments as well as on the Moon. Do those experiments, were there sediments that corroborated the age of those particular planets along with the Earth and those kind of things?
Well, we can date the origin of the solar system as a whole through looking at chondritic meteorites. Those are kind of the primitive building blocks that led to the formation of the planets and comets and asteroids. And that comes in at 4.5662 billion years ago. We've now got a radiometric dating on the Moon, which establishes that the Moon is about 30 to 40 million years younger than the Earth. That's why we recognize that the Moon did not form out of the solar nebula. It was a result of a later collision event. So we can document that that's got a later age. With Mars, we've got, I think it's now 22 Martian meteorites. This is bits and pieces of Mars that got transported from the Mars to Earth. And that tells us that Mars is at least 4.4 billion years old. But everything we know about the physics of Mars tells us that it must have the same age as the Earth.
That's all by radiometric.
All by radiometric dating.
Sedimentary exploration, as far as taking core samples?
Well, no, that won't work because that only takes you back to the time when you got the first rocks, and the first rocks don't show up until 3.86 billion years ago. So that's not going to get you back to the beginning of the Earth. That's why they use the chondritic meteorites to come up with that date. And there's a little bit of wiggle room in the sense, how do you define the actual beginning of the Earth? You define it when it's 50% of its present size, because the way the moon forms is it's coal, or probably the Earth forms, is coalescing material. Well, a date of 4.5662 billion is the date when the Earth essentially comes together with a size a little bit bigger than Venus. I say that because the moon forming event added mass to the Earth. So the Earth today is bigger than what it was when it first formed. But yeah, when we talk about the formation of planets, we're basically talking about that moment when they reached about 99% of their present size.
Hi, Doctor. My question is on gravitational waves and if there's any more research on that. And do those waves have anything to do with spiritual warfare or the human consciousness as they travel across the universe and eventually come to Earth? And the battles we as Christians go through, that spiritual battle, does the enemy use that at all? Did any of the science?
Okay, good question. There are four fundamental forces of physics. You've got electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, and you got the force of gravity. And with each one, there are particles and waves. But gravity is by far the weakest of the four forces of physics. And therefore, we have yet to detect gravity waves. The other forces of physics, we've made the detections. But we have yet to detect a graviton, which is a particle that undergirds the force of gravity, and we've yet to detect gravity waves. However, we're getting tantalizingly close. They've upgraded the LIGO experiment. That's an experiment that was developed by Caltech and MIT physicists, where they have three arms of an interferometer, one in the state of Washington, one in the state of Louisiana, and they've just opened up a third arm in Pisa, Italy. And they've been doing a number of experiments, but so far all they got are upper limits. But the upper limits are really close to where we actually expect to see gravity wave detection. Now, we know there must be gravity waves because we can observe phenomena in the universe that would be impossible unless there were gravity waves. And so when we're looking at, say, very small galaxies, Segway 1 is probably the best example, where you see a very intense concentration of exotic dark matter. We know that there must be gravity wave phenomena taking place. Probably the one that's easiest for laymen to appreciate is that there's one double pulsar that we see, two neutron stars that are orbiting one another, and we've already been able to detect that the orbits are beginning to get smaller and smaller. In other words, they're on their way to merging together. Now, the merging time is still 88 million years off. However, we can actually see them getting close enough together, and the only way the orbit can decay is through the radiation of gravity waves. And so the fact that we can measure the decay of the orbit of this one binary pulsar tells us the gravity wave phenomenon is there. But our instruments are not yet sensitive enough to pick up the gravity waves from that pulsar. On the other hand, if you get two neutron stars that collide with one another, you'll definitely see the gravity waves, even if it's happening in a distant galaxy. So it's just a matter of time before we see a colliding neutron star event, and then our current instruments will pick up the gravity waves. So it's kind of a wait and see thing. But there's plenty of evidence that gravity waves are actually taking place.
I went to a presentation at Caltech about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the physicist making the presentation, he used the word bulk. I think he used it as a variable to describe God in the presentation, I think just to be politically correct. And if I'm paraphrasing what he said, but he kind of brought up that them being able to detect gravity waves was further proof of the existence of the bulk, or he said God. And he refrained from using God, but kept using the word bulk. So I was curious on if that's such a maybe milestone in astrophysics.
Well, it's a milestone in the sense that the heart of the biblical creation model is that everything is consistent and harmonious. And therefore, we would expect that there would be a unifying principle throughout all of physics. Einstein, who believed in God, said there's got to be a unified field theory out there and spent the last decades of his life searching for that unified field. Well, the one missing component is gravity. So that's kind of the holy grail of particle physics and particle creation models, is to try to actually detect gravitons and gravity waves, because that would really kind of complete our understanding of unified field physics. So we're close, but we're not there yet. But I don't know of a physicist in the world that doesn't believe that the unified field theory is true. And that's a model that would be, very consistent with what the Bible teaches. So I think that's why he used biblical terminology there. But in terms of your question, do the angels or God communicate to us through gravity waves? I don't think so. We have been told in Psalm 51 and Psalm 139, when God creates a human being, at the moment of conception, that's when the spirit of the person is created. So we have spiritual existence from that very point. See, why do we need the body? The body is basically a piece of hardware that's an interface for a spirit to communicate with other spirits. Think of it as like an automobile. And so when you die, you get rid of your automobile and you get a new one. Now, that's what death is all about from a Christian perspective. Nothing happens to the spirit. The spirit simply leaves the body and goes elsewhere. Which means that when God, His Holy Spirit, is communicating with us, He's going to be communicating through the spirit realm, not through the physical realm. He doesn't need gravitons or gravity waves. It's so weak, it's not going to be of any value anyway. So
would the enemy use any of the science?
No, I don't think so either. I mean, because after all, the angelic realm are spirit beings. And so, likewise, they're going to be communicating through the spirit realm. And for what it's worth, in terms of the fallen or evil angels, they can only communicate with us or interfere with us if we give them permission. They need permission. So I've been in countries where there's a lot of demonic activity, but it's because people are giving permission. And so in that sense, they're under authority.
Doctor, I'm curious with, in John, when we're told, believe in Jesus, basically, believe in Jesus, and we're going to go to heaven. How would you explain all the millions and billions of people in different religions, Buddhists, Muslim, Jews, whatever, that don't believe in Jesus? Are they not going to heaven? And that's what goes through. And I know that we, right, like in our church, sometimes we sing the song of, our God is great, and yet I'm sure that other people feel the same thing about their God. How do you explain that?
Well, first of all, if you simply go through the Old Testament, you'll see that the Son of God has 88 different names. And each of those names is describing a feature or an attribute of the second person of the triune God. And so it's not necessary that someone in Africa know the name of Jesus of Nazareth or what Jesus of Nazareth did. They simply need to recognize who God is, what are God's attributes, and what God has offered to the human species. And then they need to receive the offer or reject the offer. And what it tells us in John chapter 1 is that God's light, and it's talking about spiritual light, has gone out to every human being, every man, woman, and child. And whoever receives that light will proceed to salvation. Whoever says no thank you to that light and rejects the light proceeds towards condemnation. And so that's the standard by which God will judge. He'll judge every person by what light they've received and what they've done with that light. There's also the promise that if you receive the light that God has given you, He will give you more light. Now, I've traveled around the world, and I can tell you the most challenging place to try to share the Christian faith is here in North America and Western Europe.
Really?
You know, I was talking to an audience where everyone was of the Hindu faith. And after it was done, all these Hindus came up to me and said, "We all know something's wrong with Hinduism. We didn't need you to come here to explain what's wrong with Hinduism." And what they explained to me is in the Hindu faith, they are taught that the world is filled with contradictions. And they said, "Well, you know, we're taking engineering, and you know, we know that that's not correct. So we knew something was wrong with Hinduism. What we needed to hear is, okay, that's what's wrong, show us what is right." But I can tell you this, the receptivity there was far greater than anything I've seen here in America. The closer you are to the truth, the harder it seems to be for people to respond to the truth. People that are far from it, no. I can give you another story. I remember going to the Soviet Union back in 1989 and 1990. And by the way, I was sponsored by the Soviet government. But they put restrictions on me, said you can only talk to people who have PhDs in the sciences, and you can talk to the Communist Party leaders. If we catch you talking to anybody else, we'll immediately deport you. And they said you can only talk in these auditoriums. Well, each auditorium I spoke in was basically a hall of scientific atheism. It was a place where the scientists every Friday had to come and hear a two-hour lecture on the scientific evidence for there being no God. And you know, what I heard from the physicists and chemists and biologists afterwards is those Friday lectures convinced them abundantly that God must exist. It says having to get a two-hour lecture every Friday on the non-existence of God, says that really convinced us. And so, and that's the one place in the world where I've seen more than 99% of the people in the audience pray to receive Christ after a one-hour message. It's that they had all, they'd heard what wasn't true, and they quickly figured out what was true. In fact, what's interesting is I had, quote, an atheist basketball player translate for me. And what he started the lecture off was he pointed everybody to a portrait of Lenin behind me, 20 feet by 20 feet. And he said, "For 70 years, this has been our God. Now we're going to hear about the real God." So 4 days later, he gave his life to Christ. So, but I think that just shows you that, you know, God's truth does get out. Or as it tells us in the book of Job, God has given us a book of nature. And the book of nature lays out the plan of salvation. The question is, do we have the humility to respond to what God has revealed? And that's why the book of Romans says everyone is without excuse. We may not all have Bibles, but we all have the record of nature. And by the way, my latest book just came out a couple of hours ago. It's the only copy I have. But I wrote this book making the point that, you know, God gave us the book of nature, but the problem with 21st century citizens, we're cut off from so much of that book of nature because we're forced to live in cities. And what you see in the book of Job is that go to the birds, go to the mammals, and they'll teach you about God. But there's a lot of people today that the only birds and mammals they have contact with are highly bred cats and dogs. It's not quite the same as being out there in the world of nature and having contact with hundreds of different species of birds and mammals, seeing how they're motivated to serve and please us, and realizing, likewise, we must be designed to serve and please a higher being, just like they're designed and serve to serve and please a higher species, and just like our sin spoils our the ability of these animals to serve and please us, likewise, it's our sin that spoils our capacity to serve and please God. It's what causes us to run away from God instead of pursuing Him. Just like these birds and mammals, because of the way we abuse them, run away from us instead of towards us. So, but I think 21st century, and by the way, every atheist scholar I've ever debated has lived in a city. I've never met an atheist out in the country. They all live in cities. Go ahead.
I have several questions from the audience, so my apologies to you if
you that I'm not going to get to them. I'll do this next one. If in heaven there is no sin, how did Lucifer the angel sin?
Well, notice the Bible tells us that he was kicked out of heaven when he sinned. So it's true. God can't tolerate sin, so Satan was removed from his presence. So, but yeah, there was a time when a third of the angels joined Satan in rebelling against him. And for that reason, they've been cut off from God. And they've been permanently cut off. Where we human beings are in a different position is we're being subjected to the laws of physics, and we decay and we die. God is using the principle decay and death to give us something he couldn't give to the fallen angels, namely redemption. And so we had a question earlier about, you know, why does God not intervene and save us from all the suffering and pain and death? He could. But he has developed a plan to use that suffering, pain, and death to deliver us from a rebellion against God into submission to him, so we can be restored from a rebellion and enjoy eternal fellowship with him. The fallen angels don't get to experience that decay. They don't get to experience death, so their rebellion was permanent, and their condemnation is permanent. And the righteous angels are mystified about how God is able to use death, pain, and suffering to redeem a fallen species into a righteous state. That's what I meant earlier when I said they watch the grace of God. We get to experience the grace of God. But the mystery of the gospel is the only way to live is to die. And the only way to gain deliverance from pain and suffering is to submit to pain and suffering. I mean, it sounds like a paradox, but that's what the Bible is all about, explaining why it's a good thing that we decay, and it's a good thing that we die.
I just was wondering if I could get your views and thoughts on sort of like, it's like the Big Bang, but the reversal of it, like the collapse theory of the Big Bang, where everything pulls back to the original point.
Right.
I was wondering, what's your thoughts on that? If that kind of theory, do you believe in that kind of theory, or do you believe that the gravitational pull will lessen and weaken through how the universe starts to spread out,
mm-hmm.
like that? That it'll just start spreading out too far for it to even happen, or if it
well,
happen.
That was a raging debate in the astronomical community back in the 1960s and 1970s. It got partly resolved in the 1980s, and in the year 1999, it got completely resolved. So let me just give you a quick history of what happened there. When I was at the University of Toronto, I shared a home with four other graduate students, and all of them were Hindus, and I was the lone Christian. So I said, well, why are you guys going with a Hindu worldview? And they said, because of the oscillating universe theory. This is the idea that the universe has a beginning, it expands, it collapses, and it restarts. And so there's this infinite cycle of the universe beginning, expanding, collapsing, and starting over again. And that's really the core of Hindu theology. A lot of people realize Hinduism teaches reincarnation, but the reincarnation doctrine of Hinduism is fundamentally based on the reincarnation of the universe. And in Hinduism, they teach that the universe reincarnates every 4.32 billion years. So I remember sharing that with my four roommates back in the 1970s, saying, you know, the Hindus got the number wrong. It's a lot more than 4.52 billion. They said, yeah, but hey, it's within a factor of 10, and for the Hindus to get that close to the right answer, it must be right. But it was shortly thereafter that three physicists published three different papers in Nature where they explained that the entropy measure of the universe, which is the rate at which the universe is decaying, is so extremely high it would rule out any conceivable bounce mechanism which would reincarnate the universe. And so that basically killed the oscillating universe model. Although there were some physicists coming up with new mathematics and new dimensionality of the universe where they thought they could save the oscillating universe model and save the Hindu worldview. What sealed it once and for all was the recognition that the universe does not have enough mass to slow down the cosmic expansion. It's only coming in at about 27% of the mass that's necessary to bring the expansion velocity of the universe to a halt. And what really sealed it was the discovery shortly thereafter that the universe is dominated by dark energy. Dark energy guarantees that the universe not only will not slow down, it will expand at a faster and faster rate as time goes on. Now, we do see the universe slowing down for the first 7 billion years of its history. And that's because when the universe is young, the space surface is small. And with the space surface being small, it means that bits and pieces of matter are close together. And that's the principle of gravity. The closer the mass of bodies are to one another, the more powerfully they attract. And so the universe is slowing down at the greatest rate when it's very young. But as the universe continues to expand, it pushes the pieces of matter farther apart. And so gravity becomes progressively weaker in its capacity to slow down the expansion of the universe. Dark energy is the opposite. Dark energy is weakest when the space surface is small. And so at the very beginning of the universe, dark energy plays no detectable role. But as the space surface gets bigger and bigger, dark energy becomes progressively more effective in accelerating the expansion of the universe. And so for the last 7 billion years, the universe measures to be expanding at a progressively more and more rapid rate, which means there's one beginning and only one beginning. The universe will never collapse. The universe will never rebound into a second stage of cosmic expansion. And the Hindu worldview has been definitively proven incorrect.
Sun has solar cycles, and there are those who are saying those solar cycles are determined by the alignment of the planets. And they're showing drafts of past and present indicating that there's, just a cycle we're going through. I'd like your input.
Yeah, well, it is true that the planets go through cycles of lining up. The cycles are quite random. It's not like every 11 years, whereas the solar cycle is quite regular. It'll be like every 10 years, every 11 years, every 12 years, but the average is 11 years. So there's only occasions where you see a lining up of the planets that coincides with a part of the solar cycle. It's a pure coincidence. Most of the time, there's no correlation at all. And we now understand what drives the solar cycle. It's the magnetic field of the sun. And so we understand the physics of the sun well enough to appreciate that's the driving engine for the solar cycle. And it explains why when you get the greatest number of sunspots, you also get the greatest flaring activity. And by the way, we're heading into solar maximum. We're already in solar maximum. And it will peak probably within the next 9 to 13 months. And when that happens, you get more flaring activity, which means you get a higher probability of seeing the aurora borealis. And two cycles ago, I saw the aurora borealis here in Los Angeles. And so you might keep your eyes peeled when you get a nice clear night, but it's nothing like what you see in Canada. Probably the best you're going to see here in LA will be a big orange spot in the sky or a blue spot. But hey, if you've never seen it, it's kind of neat. So, I just wrote a paper on our Today's New Reasons to Believe on our reasons.org website. For the first time, they've been able to detect a correlation between the solar cycle and health. Namely, that at solar maximum, you get a greater incidence of cervical cancers, for example, and cervical diseases. And they've also been able to document that the male heart rate goes up very slightly and our blood pressure goes up very slightly, but I mean very slightly. There's no need for all of you to panic about your health next year. It literally took decades of very painstaking medical records for them to even detect the very slight health correlation with the solar cycle. But it's interesting for me as an astronomer, because as an astronomer I realize that there's an extremely narrow window of time when the sun has the minimum activity in its solar cycle. and we're right in that window right now. Which means if God created us any earlier than 4.5662 billion years after the Earth was formed, we would be exposed to greater risk from the solar cycle, any earlier, any later. You say, well, how big is the window of time? It's about 100,000 years wide. So when you're looking at 4.5 billion years of solar history, we're in that one narrow window when it's relative, when it's possible for us human beings to actually live 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years. At any other time, our lifespan would be significantly shorter because of the solar cycle. So, something else to thank God for when you celebrate your Thanksgiving dinner.
Hello. My understanding is after we pass, we either go up or we go down. Well, my question resides in the paranormal. How would you explain spirits and or ghosts?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can go get her book over there, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. That's the long answer. The short answer is that there is a spirit realm. God made two different species of intelligent life, human beings and angels. And the angels fall into two categories, the fallen angels and the righteous angels. And the fallen angels have as their mission to distract us from developing a relationship with God. And so they've got all kinds of ways to keep us distracted. But as I said earlier, they need permission. They're not allowed to distract you unless you give them the right to distract you. You say, well, how do you give them permission? It's basically through occult activities, which is why the Bible warns us against practicing astrology or witchcraft or engaging in seances, which is basically an attempt to call up these angelic spirits and try to get power from them. And that's basically what these fallen angels promise, the human contacts. If you let us have a relationship with you, we'll give you power that no other human being has. And the power is real, but there's a big price. You will suffer if you receive that power. But there's also a way to cut it off, basically get rid of the invitation cards. And so that's why my book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, and the reason for that title is we're primarily addressing the UFO phenomena. And ever since I've been 16, I've been processing UFO reports. That's one of the consequences of being an astronomer. You get the phone calls, I saw this in the sky, can you tell me what it is? I can explain about 99% of everything people reported to me as UFOs. At the very top of the list is the planet Venus. But I remember one time getting a call from the California Highway Patrol that they were chasing a UFO, and they claimed that they were gaining on it. They were chasing the planet Venus. They said, you're not going to catch it. So. But the problem is, for those of us who live in cities, a lot of us have never seen Venus as a bright morning star. When it's up there as a bright morning star, you can read a newspaper by it. You know, when people see it for the first time, they think they've seen a UFO. And that's just one of hundreds of different natural phenomena that people report as UFOs. But there's a 1% residual where they're actually encountering a spiritual dimension or spiritual beings. And these are typically the close encounters with UFOs, defined as being closer than 500 feet. And the best you're going to come away with one of those encounters is repeated terrifying nightmares. And there's actually people who've been killed by the encounters. So it's not benign. There are very painful consequences to those kinds of encounters. Now today, they appear as flying saucers. 1,000 years ago, they came as leprechauns. These fallen angels can take whatever physical form they want. They can appear as animals, they can appear as your dead grandfather, they can appear as a flying saucer. And they seem to keep pace with our technology. And they love to give you secret information, but consistently the information is always flawed. So 100 years ago, they claimed that they were from the backside of the moon. When nobody was fooled by that, they said we're from Mars. And then they said we're from one of the moons of Jupiter. Now they're claiming to be from a distant planetary system because they realize that the common man knows that our solar system is not a candidate. So they're not going to fool people with that anymore. But whatever they tell you about astronomy, that's always incorrect to some degree. So it's one of the ways you can put it to the test. But I actually have a list in the book of about 42 different categories of invitation cards. And we refer to our model on these fallen angels as a testable model in this sense. If you will take away the invitation cards, that will be the end of your occult experiences. That will be the end of your close encounters with UFOs. And you can do the reverse experiment. Grab a whole bunch of invitation cards and watch what happens. I don't recommend it, but there's plenty of statistical evidence in the book that where you go and around the world where people are practicing the occult, you'll see a very high incidence of UFO encounters and occult experiences. I particularly saw that in the Soviet Union. And what was happening in the Soviet era is that the government leaders knew they were falling behind technologically with the United States in the arms race. And so they were trying to get one up on America by pursuing occult physics. And what was surprising to me when I was lecturing the Soviet Union is every university had a department of occult physics. Where these physicists were doing experiments, basically running seances and making contact with these demons. And I remember giving one lecture in Kiev where half the physicists in my audience were demon-possessed. So, and everybody there, like here in America, people doubt the existence of demons. Nobody in the Soviet Union era doubted the existence of demons. They saw the evidence everywhere. And every time I spoke on UFOs, the place was packed to the gills. So people crashed it, even though they didn't have PhDs. They just wanted to hear about this stuff, because they were terrified by it.
Thank you.
Anyway, it's over there. Lights in the sky, little green man.
Another question from the audience, Hugh. There's a passage in Genesis regarding the time after the flood, where God says that he's destroyed the earth with water, that next time it will be with fire. Can you explain what you think that means?
Well, there are three places in the Bible where it talks about how God will end the existence of the universe. Says he'll roll it up like a scroll and it will disappear in a fiery heat. And there's actually one version of the Big Bang creation model that predicts the universe will end exactly that way. It's what's called the ekpyrotic Big Bang model. And you know, if you read any textbook on Big Bang cosmology, it talks about how the universe is a 10-dimensional flat sheet, or very nearly a 10-dimensional flat sheet. In other words, very close to being flat. Don't talk about 2-dimensional flatness, we're talking 10-dimensional flatness. But there are those who have pointed out that the universe that we have today is not the same as the universe that we see. Because the universe we see is the universe of the past. And the universe of the past is smaller than the universe of today. So we're not seeing the whole of the universe. We're simply seeing the universe as it was. And therefore they point out that yes, the universe could be a 10-dimensional flat sheet. But because the universe of today is bigger than the universe that we actually can see through our telescopes, and bigger by at least a factor of 800 times, it's possible that this flat universe curls up like a U, where it's flat here and we can see the flatness, but if you go beyond what we can see, it actually curls in and folds back in on itself, such that you've got a 10-dimensional sheet in which we live, but directly above it is another 10-dimensional sheet. And if you put the sheets about a millimeter apart, then over the course of 20 billion years, there's a 50% probability that a quantum space-time fluctuation in the top sheet will make contact with a space-time quantum fluctuation in the bottom sheet. And when that happens, the entire universe disappears into a point in a fiery heat, and it's gone.
Sounds like a movie.
Well, it sounds like the last chapter of the book of Isaiah in two places, a place in 2 Peter. Chapter 3 speaks about it, and it's also in the book of Revelation. Now, I'm not saying that that's the correct interpretation of those three texts, but I'm saying if you take them, those three texts, in a very literal sense, it's exactly what you'd expect from the ekpyrotic Big Bang model. But there have been Bible scholars who are saying that there may be metaphors embedded in those three texts. So maybe it's not exactly ekpyrotic, but it is true that those three passages are saying in some way, shape, or form, the universe will disappear by all the space-time dimensionality being sucked into a point and there being a fiery heat at the end. And then we move into the new creation.
Well, you may have answered my question, although I have no idea if you did or not. I'm thinking of an analogy of the shape of the universe and where we are in it. I mean, I've heard of many different analogies. I know you've sometimes talked about how the universe is like an expanding balloon and all matter's on the outside of it,
right?
Which implies the inside is kind of empty. Another analogy that I've heard is that's like a big watermelon, that there's a certain amount of density throughout, and as it expands, more density is created. It's lumpy, there's filaments, you know, there's seeds, but it's expanding. What would be the best analogy? Are we on the inside of something looking to the outside, or if we're on the outside?
Well, here's an analogy that you can use. Let's ignore the six tiny dimensions that accompany the four big ones. Think of planet Earth. Planet Earth is a three-dimensional body, but where do we human beings live? We live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. Now, for the universe, pop everything up by one dimension. All the stars and galaxies are constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional Earth. Now, because the surface is three dimensions instead of just two dimensions, there's room for it to be thick and lumpy. But the center of the universe no longer exists. The universe expanded from that center. Everything is constrained to the surface. And there's nothing interior to that surface. There's nothing exterior to the surface. But the surface gets bigger with every year that passes by. Don't try to visualize it. It can't be done. Don't try to visualize the 10-dimensional flatness. That can't be done either. Nobody can do it. But we do know it's true. And incidentally, that's a principle throughout all of physics. We physicists study lots of things that we cannot visualize, and we know we'll never be able to visualize them, but we know they're true. Same thing's true of Christian theology. That's what separated for me the Bible from all the other holy books of the religions of the world. The Bible is the only holy book I study that described God, His attributes, and His plan for humanity in a way that was impossible for we human beings to visualize. I didn't see that in the Quran or Hinduism or Buddhism. It was completely visualizable, which to me was evidence that they were concocted by human beings without divine inspiration. The creator of the universe, we would expect, would try to communicate from his transcendent perspective, and that's what we see in the Bible. So only the Bible teaches that God is a triune being. Only the Bible teaches that God has given us free will and holds us responsible for the choices we make, yet at the same time is predetermined every thought, word, and action that we perform throughout our whole life. If you look in the Quran, it teaches that God controls everything and we human beings have no control. If you look at Hinduism and Buddhism, we human beings control everything and God has no control. Christianity says it's both. It's a paradox. You can't visualize it, but we do know that if God has access to the equivalent of three dimensions of time or more, there are multiple solutions to that paradox. If you want to see how it all works out, I got it in a book over there called Beyond the Cosmos.
I've encountered Christians that are of the belief that second law of thermodynamics, sin, evil, suffering, and death, plate tectonics, storms, all began with the fall of Adam and Eve. Genesis 3:16, God is telling Eve something that seems to me that it implies that she knows what childbirth pain is about. And it also is corroborated in Psalms and Job about the animals where they give birth to their young.
Right.
Does this make an argument against what these particular types of Christians are thinking or present?
I think it does. Because what you see in the curse in Genesis 3 is not that God is going to bring pain for the first time to human beings. He says more pain. And it's not God giving Adam work for the first time. He says there'll be more work. And it also tells us in Jeremiah 33:25 that he created the universe with fixed laws of physics. And it's those fixed laws that ensure that we will experience work and pain. And that work and pain are tools that God can use to encourage us to depart from evil and to pursue virtue. Because none of us likes extra work. Well, the way to avoid extra work is to manage the planet in the way God told us to manage the planet. But if we exercise selfishness, we wind up making things worse and we have to work harder to set things right. And we waste time. And there's more pain. And it's something that all of us as parents have learned. The most effective way to discipline our children is to give them disciplinary consequences that guarantees more pain, more work, and more wasted time. But be careful. I noticed one thing with both of my sons. They're really good at transferring the extra pain, extra work, and wasted time to their parents. So we have to be one step ahead of them to make sure they're the ones that suffer the consequences of the laws of physics and not us. So, and see, that's why God holds those in authority to be responsible to make sure that the ones who perpetrate the evil suffer the consequences of extra time. That's what the prison system is all about, right? We put you in prison, you're going to waste time. And you're going to experience pain, and there'll be extra work, although I'm not sure our present prison system is as effective as it needs to be in those categories. But that's why God told Adam and Eve, not that he changed anything, he says, because of your sinful behavior, you'll experience more pain, more work, more wasted time. Or what does he say? Cursed is the ground because of you, Genesis 3:17. God didn't curse the ground. It's our sinful behavior that caused the ground to be less productive for us human beings. Cursed is the ground because of you, not because of any physics that God changed.
But then Genesis 3:14, how is the serpent cursed more than the cattle? How does that take shape? You will be cursed more than the cattle.
Well, that leads into, because when you go through the Bible, Satan is called a snake, a dragon, he's called a roaring lion. He uses all kinds of animal figures for Satan's behavior. Now, what the curse that God pronounces upon Satan that has no metaphor, he says, the seed of the woman will crush your head and kill you. Okay? And you will go after the heel of Adam and Eve. I think one of the ways that that's happening, we talked about this yesterday in the Skeptics Forum, is that Satan has a mission to destroy the image of God on the human species. And that's why he uses a tool of sex and a tool particularly of bestiality to try to get the image of God destroyed. And that explains why Paul says of sexual sins that they're more defiling than other sins we commit, because there's an impact on the image of God. And so there's a battle going on between the human species and the fallen angels led by Satan to preserve the image of God in terms of what we human beings are to do, and then he's on a mission to attack the image of God. But it is decreed in Genesis chapter 3 that the offspring of Adam and Eve would be the end of Satan and the demons.
So if he can get enough people to die and go to hell, he thinks God's going to change his mind and he'll not be cursed anymore?
Yeah, that's Satan's great hope. He says, if I can get enough human beings to stay in rebellion against God the Creator, then God in his great love and mercy is not going to send them all to hell. And if he doesn't send them to hell, he can't send me to hell. So that's kind of the last gasp hope that he has. And that's why what you see in demonic activity, they do everything they can to divert you from pursuing a relationship with Jesus Christ. One of the things I describe in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men is that what you see in the UFO phenomena is the spiritual transmission of the equivalent of an occultic Bible called the Urantia book. It's 2,000 pages long, so it's twice as long as the Bible, and a third of the content of the Urantia book is denying the deity of Jesus Christ. So, I mean, that to me is a real clue about what's going on here. Why is so much of the content of that book focused on trying to deny the deity of Jesus Christ? Yeah, well, I mean, there's many ways that Satan tries to divert us. Go ahead.
You were going to do one more question, and then we're going to wrap up, but I want to ask everybody, during the last question, the two forms, especially the large one, especially those of you who haven't been here before, if you would fill it out, it would really be a big help to us. Go ahead, sir.
I'm not sure if everybody believes this or not, but eventually money will not exist. And at what point is God going to be there to intervene when money no longer exists and the value of property does not exist anymore? The property will be the property of God. At what point are we going to be there at times? I know that the humans are very immature right now to let go of all things that they have. They think they're worth a lot of value. But the value of God is the value that we have internally inside of us. So I'm asking, is there a point in the future or the near future that we are going to be there at that point? Or just waiting 9 million years before everybody...
Yeah, I'm not sure where you're going with your question, but let me take a stab at it and feel free to correct me.
The question is, are we ever going to be at the point where we don't need any money anymore?
Well, yeah, we will be at a point where we don't need any money anymore because we'll be in the new creation, those of us who have submitted our lives to Jesus Christ, where there'll be completely different laws of physics, completely different dimensions. Gold and silver won't exist anymore. There will be other riches that will exist. There will be riches in the new creation, but it's not going to be the riches we have here. It tells us in Revelation 21, everything that exists in this realm will no longer exist in the new creation.
I understand that part. But so, I'm saying, does it could exist before that?
Well, there are a set of prophecies in the book of Revelation that tell us that before Jesus Christ returns to planet Earth to put an end to the age and to usher us into the new creation, that Satan will raise up followers who introduce a cashless society. And so this is not going to be something by the hand of God, it's going to be by the hand of the evil one to eliminate the exchange of money from one individual to another. It's not exactly a cashless society. It says people will trade with one another through a number that will be imprinted on your forehand or your forehead. So it's basically the Antichrist coming and eliminating all cash, eliminating all credit cards, banking and that all kind of thing, and you'll be simply buying and selling through the equivalent of an embedded credit card in your forehead or your forearm.
Yeah, I understand that too. But what I'm trying to ask you is, there are countries out there that are cashless societies that live a very simple life as of now. Can we exist that way too?
Like a barter society?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you might call them a cashless society, but they are trading.
They're trading, yes.
And that's the equivalent of cash. I mean, cash is just a more efficient way to barter with one another. And a credit card is sometimes more efficient than cash for bartering. And actually, this system of
I know it's necessary to barter and cash. What I'm trying to say is that why is such a difference between the rich and the poor? Why do we have to be that way? Why can't we be more of equal society? There's the Republicans, Democrats.
Okay, I see where you're going with that.
But I didn't want to go there at that point. What I'm trying to say is that can we exist within ourselves as Christians, knowing the fact that we are Christians, and not be so selfish at the same time?
Well, we see that in the book of Acts, that when the church was born, people would share with one another. So those who had plenty would share with those that didn't. And they would pool their resources, and the elders of the church would disperse it to whoever had the needs. And there were some abuses of that system. So you see in the book of Titus that Paul was calling certain new believers to account by saying, okay, we have this system of sharing, but some of you aren't working. And if you will not work, you will not eat. You say, you need to be active and productive so that you can be contributing to the needs of those who aren't able to work. So the whole point is, if you're able to work, if you're able to be productive, you not only need to be productive, you need to be overproductive, so in your overproductivity, you can give to the needs of those who are not able to work. And so, that's a Christian principle, that we're to be engaged in charity. And by the way, I believe in private charity rather than government charity. It'd be really great if we could be privately supporting the poor. Yeah. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of America, is that over the centuries, we have been one of the more generous nations, not only to other nations, but to our own people. But it's also a principle there that every dollar that the government takes away for government charity is $1.50 less that's available for private charity. So maybe we need a system where we actually give tax breaks to people that are generous with their resources. But the bottom line is, you've still got selfishness. And selfishness is not limited to non-Christians. There are Christians.
I have realized that. Absolutely, I realized that.
And so we are to be generous in giving to others.
Yeah, sure.
So
I don't have a problem with that.
And by the way, it tells us in the Bible that God gave us the poor so that we can be generous towards them. It's important that all of us have that spirit of generosity. And so it's crucial that God place before us people in need so we can practice that generosity.
Let's all show our appreciation for Dr. Ross. Thank you. Before we go, Hugh, would you close us in prayer?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've had together this evening. We look forward to other discussions and dialogues and debates that we can have on these subjects. And Lord, we pray too that you would give us the capacity to share insights and truth with others, Lord, that we can all be pursuing.